Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're tuned into another episode of Real College Podcast, Quarantine Edition, and I'm your host, Casey McCabe. Much like all of you, we here at Real College Podcast have been spending a lot of time in our homes during the pandemic. Now that spring has seemingly sprung here in Minneapolis with the last of the snow melting away, people seem to be spending a lot more time outdoors. Although it has been great to get out and stretch our legs, we here at Real College Podcast, just like the rest of you, need to do a bit of spring cleaning. In this episode of Real College Podcast, we bring you some treasures from the vault alongside some new content. Come along with us and discover how pets can help us cope with stress, take a dive into education reform, understand why you are jealous of your vaccinated friends, uncover what it's like to be pregnant behind bars, learn more about the origins of street art, and sit down with the local band Sapphire to discuss their music. You won't want to miss this. Be sure to stick around. In our first segment of the episode, we will hear from reporter Casey Salazar. During the pandemic, we all have been handling our stress in different ways, but here in Minnesota, we may all have one thing in common, our love of pets. Here's Casey with more.
When I go on a walk, even on a rough day, if I see a dog, I will ask to pet them, and that usually makes my day. But I believe I am not the only one who acts this way. I have observed other people, and even students on campus, asking to pet other humans' pets. I think it's a Minnesotan thing to do. Here in Minnesota, we even have restaurants that open their patios to their guests and dogs, and offer dedicated dog menus. I believe it's safe to say we Minnesotans love our dogs, and when we see one, we will ask to pet them. Beyond just petting pets, I wanted to know how pets help us cope with stress, especially during pandemic times. But first, we need to understand what is stress.
I think about stress as being a gap between your list of responsibilities or expectations and then your ability to meet those demands.
This is the definition of stress according to Professor Liza Meredith. She is an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the psychology department. Professor Meredith explains how people shoulder stress.
And then I think the experience of stress can vary from person to person. Like some people experience it primarily in their emotions. They feel more irritable or overwhelmed or sad, anxious, whereas others experience stress more so in their thinking. They just notice racing thoughts or maybe having more irrational thinking, whereas other people experience it more in their behavior. They just notice they're like quick to cut people off or tend to overeat. And so although we all probably have experienced stress from time to time, it may kind of manifest differently for each of us.
Based on research Professor Meredith has conducted, she has found that academics is the number one reason why students suffer stress. Within academics, there are different stressors, the most common one being not having enough time to meet academic demands. But now with COVID, it's a new stress students have to deal with.
So I think there are some students that changing to primarily online learning hasn't really been too big of a deal, or for some, they actually may even prefer it. Like I have some students in my online sections who like online schools for me, it's great. But I think for many others, online learning and the pandemic has made academics that much harder because you don't necessarily feel as connected to the subject when you're not meeting with an instructor or your peers face to face. In addition to that, it requires the student to really be in charge and responsible, right? So like you have to remember to check your assignments on Canvas or to like do a discussion post at a certain time. Like the onus is really on the student to stay on top of things.
As we all know, stress can affect your physical health and mental health. Having a stressful day once in a while will not affect you negatively. Stress will only lead to problematic effects if it's consistent and prolonged. Professor Meredith shares her findings on how pets can help us humans cope with stress.
Having a pet does seem to relieve stress. And there's a number of different theories about why that is. But it sounds like through research studies, there's been a link that ownership of a pet decreases cortisol, which is like the stress hormone in our body, and also lowers blood pressure. So there does seem to be a link between people having a pet and showing benefits in their physical health and their stress response.
I can definitely attest that having dogs have helped me relieve some stress during stressful times. Being able to distract myself with my dog by taking them on a walk, not only they get excited, but I also start to feel better. I also wanted to get more insight a personal testimony to see if what I felt, others also felt.
And my life has gotten a lot better. They definitely bring happiness and joy.
This is Brenda Gutierrez Rosas, a senior at St. Thomas University, double majoring in psychology and family studies. She owns a 7-month-old male Shih Tzu named Toby. Brenda shares why they got a pet.
We got him because we started talking about getting a pet early in the summer. We all feel like we're all grown enough to like take care of a pet and take on the responsibilities. And then my brother kind of helped figure out everything into like getting a pet. In August, we were notified that we could have one of the babies that the mom was having. In October, a couple months later, we finally got to pick him up and meet him.
When getting a new puppy and never having owned a pet before, it's life-changing. Lots of things change when adopting a new pet, such as new routines, more spending, and less free time. But not all of these changes are seen negatively.
It's changed in a positive way. Like, I have more responsibilities and I have to like take care of someone who like fully depends on me. So I feel like that's really great because it kind of helps me go about my day and have a motivation to like wake up and like do things as opposed to like just kind of sitting and not doing anything. So he just brings a lot of joy and like responsibility, but like in a positive way.
As college students, stress is always surrounding us at certain points in the semester, whether it's midterms, finals, or lots of homework. Brenda shares how Toby helps her relieve her stress.
I had a couple exams, like papers due a couple weeks ago, for example, and I was just a lot of stress going on, so I was extremely stressed. And I feel like whenever I'm around him, like I can forget about the assignments and forget about what's going on and just kind of like give him attention, give him love. He loves me absolutely. He's like loyal to me. So it's like really nice to just kind of think about him and play around with him and not have to worry about like stressful factors in my life.
It is no secret that the pandemic has changed our lives drastically, from stay-at-home orders to avoid physical socializing, to wearing a mask everywhere. The pandemic itself caused a lot of stress.
Back when the pandemic started, we went into like lockdown and everything shut down and like everything went online. I was doing really bad mentally. There was a lot of stress and a lot of things going on. So my mental health wasn't at its finest. And it kind of got better as I got hobbies to kind of keep myself busy during quarantine like everyone else did. Like there was that baking time, there was like crafts and everything and all that. But then it kind of got worse over the summer again with just like other factors going on in my life. And when we got him, I think I was once again at like a low point. So my mental health wasn't at its finest. But ever since we've got him, I'm not saying that my mental health is like gone and everything's better, but I definitely feel that he like helps me out a lot and get through the days. So if I didn't have him, I think I'd still be in that same position I was like a year ago, if not even like worse.
I had to conclude by asking, if everyone was stable, had the time and desire, and would be responsible, should people own a pet?
I definitely think everyone should own a pet. They bring so much happiness and so much joy. I mean, I wanted a pet since like who knows how long, and then I finally got one, and my life has gotten a lot better. Not everyone can own a pet, but if everyone can own a pet, I would 100% recommend it.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Casey Salazar.
During the COVID-19 pandemic, there have been increased concerns about the impacts of quarantining and staying at home on the children who should be attending school. Although at the college level, our education, lives, and routines have all been drastically affected, we can at least understand why. In many cases, the pandemic has served to highlight existing disparities in our education system. In order to understand what was lacking in our schools pre-COVID, as well as how the pandemic has affected our students, I spoke with Suzanne DeMalley, a math teacher from the Baltimore County Public School System and the author of the book, Can You Hear Me Now? Suzanne explains why she wrote the book.
Why I wrote the book? Basically because I was very concerned with the direction that our public education system is going. And I really believe that if we don't start to turn it around and make significant improvements, that at some point in the near future, it could be that only the kids who have no other choice are attending those public schools rather than all kids making the choice to attend a public school. You know, if it continues to decline at the rate it's going, you know, the people who have the finances will pull their kids out of the public system and put them in private schools and they have another alternative. But again, unfortunately that would leave the kids who financially can't afford it and they're left in the public schools. And I believe that every child deserves a quality education. I think that education is an opportunity for anyone in life, regardless of where they come from, what their circumstances are, to really have a good life in the future.
Suzanne went on to explain why the current system isn't working and why it's so complex.
There's lots of problems, you know, in our school system. If I had to sort of narrow them down to two, I would say that we're expecting the schools to really solve all of society's problems right now. We're really putting it on teachers and administrators at the school level to fix all of the problems. And yet, you know, we're not giving them more time in the day to do that. So the time that teachers are spending to try to fill in those social emotional needs and address those other issues are really being taken away from instruction. So we, you know, if we're going to put it on the schools to try to take care of those needs, then we need to give the schools more time. And the schools also don't have the resources for it. You know, we have a lot of kids in our school system that are just coming from homes that where they're just not having those social emotional needs being taken care of. They don't know how to manage their emotions. They have a lot of suppressed anger. And we're not giving the schools the psychologist and the social workers that would help to take care of those things. We're expecting the teachers to do it.
Suzanne highlighted the scope of the issues covered in her book.
In the book, I also really focus on five topics that I really experienced with problems in education. Common Core, technology, grading policies, English language learners, and then I talk about behaviors and discipline. You know, a lot of the school policies are being made by people who aren't in a classroom every day, and they're not aware of our very diverse student population. It's not a one-size-fits-all solution. So they come up with these policies and practices that they want implemented by all the schools. And every school is different depending on, you know, what kids are going there and what community support there is. And so I think that is contributing to a lot of the problems. So, you know, you can't have a one size fits all policy for everyone.
The first of these topics pointed out by Suzanne, Common Core, refers to the Common Core grading standards as well as increased standardized testing due to President Bush's 2001 No Child Left Behind Act. Suzanne reflected on the educational landscape pre-2001.
It was pre-Common Core. Kids were getting good grades. Kids were scoring really well on the standardized test. But a lot of that was because teachers were really teaching to the test. They were doing a lot of reviews that would always mirror the test questions. You know, I have no problem with teaching, reviewing skills that are going to be a test and preparing a student for the types of questions that are going to be on the test. But when that becomes the focus of instruction and the target just to get a certain percentage of students to score proficient on an exam, I think we're missing the bigger picture. You know, first of all, you're placing a lot of reliance then on the fact that it's a valid test, that it's a good test. Not all tests are. Not all tests are really going to measure a student's understanding, let's say, of math, for example.
Suzanne went on to explain how Common Core and No Child Left Behind may have negatively impacted our educational system.
We have to stop trying to just make our focus so assessment oriented. It puts a lot of pressure on the kids. It puts a lot of pressure on the teachers. And I think it's just taking away from the bigger picture of what education should be. And when teachers are forced to really just teach for a test, I think we're then sort of trying to teach the kids more of a fixed way of thinking or to recognize a question as opposed to more of this flexible ability to interpret something. And you know, in life and in careers and in school, the more flexible your mind is about being able to look at a situation and use what you already know to help you navigate through it, the better off you're going to be.
However, Suzanne noted that there are some good things about the Common Core curriculum.
There are some things I like about Common Core. The reason that Common Core came about is because there was a concern that we had different proficiency levels amongst all the states. And we had some kids in some states who might score proficient on a standardized test, but not in another state. So that was one reason. And then the other concern that prompted Common Core was that there were so many standards before Common Core, and they felt like it was the standards were a mile wide and an inch deep, meaning that they expect you to know so many things, but not really at a deep level. So I like sort of the reasons that Common Core was started, and I do like some of the things about it. Again, I taught math, so my experience is with the math Common Core standards.
Although there are some good things about the new curriculum, Suzanne notes that the 2001 change has proven particularly problematic during the pandemic.
Parents don't understand it. And I actually just read an article recently in a magazine talking about, you know, with COVID, so many kids are falling behind, particularly at the elementary level. And on the reading side, it's thought that parents are really able to help their kids a little more at home with what they're missing out on reading instruction in the schools. But with math, the parents cannot do that because parents themselves don't understand Common Core. So they aren't able to help their kids as much fill in those gaps at home. I think if Common Core had been thought through a little more carefully and rolled out a little bit more thoughtfully in terms of the curriculums that were designed and the training for the teachers and some background for the parents, people would have a better perception of it, and I think it would be working better.
Another topic that is central to Suzanne's book are ELL programs, or programs for English language learners. Suzanne went on to detail how these programs differ from school to school and how they can be problematic.
There are really three different instructional programs that schools use to help their English language learners. And the one that's most commonly used, it's called the ESL program. And that's where they pull kids out and they give them for a certain, let's say like an hour twice a week, or maybe an hour once a week. And they give them very intense basic language English instruction. But that means that the remainder of the time, the kids are sitting in a classroom where they're hearing English, and they might not be achieving all of their academic needs just because they don't understand what's being said.
Suzanne went on to detail the alternative ways that schools are approaching educating students for whom English is a second language.
There's two other programs, and some of those balance more of giving instruction in the child's native language. But there are some issues with the Civil Rights Act, where we don't want to segregate kids, that cause school districts to say, well, I don't want to use this one method where I might have to segregate the kids so that I can instruct them in their native language, because then I may have some legal issues. So, you know, in that case, we have to kind of balance our laws with the children's needs, with what the school can provide. I think for one thing, we need to help the ELL kids. We really need teachers to have more credentials in ELL instruction. Right now, I believe it's only 2.5% of our teachers are actually certified in bilingual instruction. So that's a really low percentage. So we need to provide incentives for teachers to take on that additional certification and get that additional education so they can help the kids.
Although much of Suzanne's extensive research is relevant nationwide, some of her findings hit closer to home. Suzanne explains why she got into teaching and why her work has been so important to her.
Well, I'm a career changer. I wasn't always a teacher. I was a CPA, which is an accountant, for a long period of time. And it wasn't really until I had my own children that I really got involved in education. So my son, who is my middle child, when he was in kindergarten, he was diagnosed with something called an auditory processing disorder. For your listeners, just to understand what that is, because I didn't know what it meant when I was first told this, you know, your ears basically are just capturing sound. They're just detecting the noises. And your brain does a lot to identify and recognize those noises and interpret them, figure out what they mean, and bring comprehension to what you're hearing. Christopher, my son, he struggled with the neurological piece of it. So his ears were working fine, but his brain was struggling to make sense of the sounds.
Suzanne highlighted how hearing is a critical issue for all students and not just her son.
I uncovered information that I just could not believe on the number of children, first of all, that have any sort of hearing impairment. I think I read a stat that on any given day of the week, 43% of primary level children will fail a minimal hearing test. And there's a lot of different reasons for that. It's not always because they have a permanent hearing problem. A lot of kids suffer from ear infections. And ear infections affect, with the fluid in the ear, affect the way the sounds are coming in and being heard. And a child with one ear infection can have their hearing impacted for several weeks, for like 6 to 9 weeks, because it takes so long for that fluid to clear. Also, children do not hear and process what they hear the same as an adult. Again, I did not know this before I did the research, but our hearing, our neurological phonological hearing ability isn't fully developed until you're in your teens. So children really actually need sounds to be a little bit louder than an adult needs to hear them, and they need to be very clearly enunciated. This means that the normal hearing child that's sitting in a classroom with poor acoustics, and maybe this child sitting in the middle to the back rows, has difficulty hearing their teacher in the front of the room, and they can actually miss up to 1/3 of what the teacher is saying. And this is, again, a normal hearing child.
Although her findings are staggering, Suzanne says there is a solution ready at hand that she has been working to promote.
In the course of my research, I uncovered that there is something called, I called it a classroom sound enhancement system, but basically it's teacher wears a microphone and we have either speakers in the ceiling of the classroom or just one speaker in the back of the classroom. It has been shown through several research studies, including one that was by the U.S. Department of Education, that we can improve academics and literacy, and it improves behaviors because kids are more on task because they can hear clearly. The results are overwhelming on the benefits of using this kind of technology in the classroom. So I kind of took it on as my mission to get that technology. Initially, I was trying to get it in my son's school, but I realized it needed to be in all schools. So then I kind of took it on for the state of Maryland, and I formed a nonprofit, and I said, I'm going to take this on a national level. And eventually, I got the support of the national PTA, which at that time was about 6 million members. And I wrote a resolution that said, you know, the national PTA would take it on as their mission to help educate people about this and encourage that schools would integrate the technology.
If you're interested in learning more about Suzanne's story and her work on reforming our education system, you can pick up a copy of her book, Can You Hear Me Now?, which is available via Amazon or anywhere that you may go to get your book fix. It is also available for digital download for those that prefer to get their read on via tablet, smartphone, or e-reader. Thank you so much to Suzanne for her work on improving the education system so it can better work for all of us. Reporting for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe. As vaccines protecting against the COVID-19 virus have been distributed around the nation, a phenomenon has arisen: vaccine jealousy. Here to help us better understand the term and why it matters is reporter Shannon Brault with more.
Minnesota has administered just over 2 million doses of the vaccine, and while there is a plan in place to vaccinate certain groups of people first, it seems that the fast-paced, changing environment has made certain groups of people eligible to receive the vaccine before other groups, which may seem more deserving.
You see people that will go out and party or go to Blarney's. Blarney's had a line down the street last night, and, oh yeah, you got the vaccine. Great. But what puts you ahead of other people like my dad? Like, he's got stage 4 prostate cancer. Like, he has started chemo. He literally just shaved his head yesterday. Like, things are getting real. And what makes you more important than my dad? And like, yes, like, you can't control when you get the vaccine. I get that. But it's just so, so frustrating when you see irresponsible people getting the vaccine and having that opportunity when other people, like, they're taking every precaution that they can and they're still not able to get the vaccine.
That's Nadia Franzen, a second year vocal performance major at the University of Minnesota.
I haven't gotten COVID yet, and I know a lot of people who, like, have gotten COVID and are now fully vaccinated. And it's like, oh, so you can go and do whatever you want without worrying about being sick. But I have been literally terrified of getting sick and doing everything I can to stay safe since day one. And I haven't gotten it. You also have to recognize, like, your privilege with it. Yeah. Because I'm privileged enough to be healthy, to, like, my family's healthy. I don't have any conditions. Like, I can work from home. Like, I don't need to put myself in danger to make money and live. Like, I have the privilege to not get the vaccine, but it's just frustrating because, like, these people also have the privilege to be as safe as they can, but they're not.
And that's Ben Villeneuve, a second-year strategic communication major. I had a roundtable discussion with the two of them about vaccine rollout, vaccine jealousy, and what this means for the campus community.
I don't know. I think just, like, something that's also been, like, making me really mad is, like, people that turn, like, Black Lives Matter into a trend by putting it into their, like, Instagram bios and doing all that stuff, but then they continue to go out and party when, like, COVID is disproportionately affecting Black people. Like, you can't say you're, like, for BLM if you're continuing, like, to put your own, like, preferences in front of other people's safety.
That's called performative activism. Yeah. I mean, I had a student on, like, the speech team that I coach do, like, whole speech on just that kind of deal, like performative activism, and just posting, like, back in June, just posting a bunch of stuff on your Instagram story, but then not actually going through with it.
Yeah, and, like, the performative activism, like, yes, we saw it over the summer with the, like, increase of, like sociopolitical activism online and on social media. And, like, it really has followed over until later in the pandemic. Like, obviously it's not a trend, but, like, more people have died down about being the social activists that they were in the summer, which is upsetting, and it's not good to see. But, like, I personally know people who posted all summer long, like, don't go out, like, wear a mask, like, do everything you can, and now they're going to frat formals, going to parties. Like, just because you're tired of it doesn't mean it's over. Mm-hmm. Like, this is still a real thing, and I don't care that you want to go to a party or go to a bar. Like follow through with your activism, and it's really annoying. Another thing that's been making me mad. Like, I saw someone post on their Instagram story, like, please get vaccinated. It's like, I'm trying. I really am. Like, I don't know what more you want me to do. Your Instagram story telling me to get vaccinated isn't going to help me get vaccinated. Like, I'm so happy for people that get vaccinated, but, like, sometimes posting on your story and is kind of infuriating. Because, like, I get that you're proud of it and you're happy that, like, you're being part of the, like, solution and the change, and I'm happy that you're doing that, but, like, I want to do it too.
It's also, like, how many people are doing it because they want to, like, look out for other people, or how many people are doing it because they're looking out for themselves? Because then there's also, like, the whole thing we're talking about where, like, people are trying to cheat the system of, like, getting a vaccine, and, like, I've even heard of some people that go in and, like, get the vaccine when they're not eligible yet. Like, they're not in the groups. They just found an opening and they go in and they mark off a box. Mm-hmm. And, like, how is that fair to even the people that have, like, these serious underlying health conditions that, like, can't even get it yet? Yeah. You know? And, like, the way that we've been rolling out the vaccine is, like, different, like, state to state, like, country to country, region to region even. Like, you have that one county that, like, anyone can go get it, but, like, what's the best way to do it, you know?
And, like what you were saying earlier about, like, are you doing it for yourself or are you doing it for others? Like, I've noticed that because I've been seeing people be like, oh, I can't wait to get the vaccine so I can go to a bar. It's like, oh, so you're doing it for yourself. I can't wait to get the vaccine so I don't accidentally bring it home to my roommates. Mm-hmm. Like, I get the vaccine, I want to get it so I don't, like, accidentally get my parents sick, get my grandparents sick, get my classmates, my coworkers sick. Like, I know it's, like, kind of, like, putting myself on a pedestal, but I'm not doing it for me. Like, of course it's good, like, to have it for myself, but that's not the main reason why I'm getting it. And to see the people that are getting it just so I can go to a bar is really annoying. Part of it is doing it for yourself, but, like, you just have to recognize that it's also doing it for other people, too. And if you're only doing it for yourself, that's selfish. Of course it's okay to do it for yourself, but you have to recognize that you're also doing it for others. Mm-hmm.
I was talking to my mom about this same thing, and she was saying, yes, like, you can be jealous, like, you can be mad. Those feelings are valid, but the only way that we are going to stop this virus is everybody being vaccinated. So, yes, every vaccination is, like, a step forward in the right direction, and as angering as it can be, and just so frustrating that you see some people that you feel like they don't deserve it. But in the end, like, yes, everybody is going to get it at some point. And, like, your turn will come. Like, it will come. Yes, your feelings are valid about whatever is going on. And no matter who gets the vaccine, it is the right direction.
In this segment from the Real College Podcast Vault, we will be hearing from reporter Petra Holtz as she helps us understand what it is like to be a pregnant woman in prison. Here is Petra with more.
For most of us, our only interaction with the idea of female incarceration is from watching Orange is the New Black. It's easy to leave the plot up to Hollywood and forget that incarceration is a real issue that many women all over the nation face. In fact, since 1980, the growing rate of female imprisonment has been twice as high as that of men, and yet their issues are just not being addressed.
Prisons were really built for men and by men with men's needs in mind.
Dr. Rebecca Schlafer is an assistant professor at University of Minnesota Medical School and the research director at the Minnesota Prison Doula Project.
And as the prison population, the women's prison population has exploded, there hasn't really been a lot of attention to thinking about how these systems and structures work for the unique needs of women and sort of what we think about as gender responsive needs.
Some of these most crucial gender-specific needs occur during pregnancy, birthing, and the postpartum period.
My name is Autumn Mason. I am 33 years old now. I'm an incarceration survivor. So I was committed to Shakopee's women's facility in April of 2014 at 7.5 months pregnant. When I went to Shakopee, I was mentally not prepared for what to expect, but I guess there's really no way to prepare for it.
Turns out the prison wasn't really prepared for her either.
My health care was my main concern as I was pregnant, and there was, needless to say, little to none initially. I requested multiple appointments and appointment after appointment and never got to see any doctor for about 3.5 weeks. When I finally was able to see a doctor, the first doctor on site, it was a 2-hour wait. And then when I was seen, they had the wrong chart. So they were asking me for medical information of someone else's.
Autumn eventually did see an OBGYN, although never at the prison itself due to understaffing and underfunding in the incarceration medical system. When she hit 36 weeks, she was granted permission to see off-grounds professionals at St. Francis Hospital Medical Center. A few weeks later, it was time to deliver.
I actually delivered my daughter on June 15th, 2014, and it was at the time 15 days after the Minnesota legislature passed the bill that they would no longer chain women during delivery. I was able to deliver my baby with the help of a doula from the Minnesota Prison Doula Project. And I was very, very comforted to have her because it was my third delivery, but it was the first one in such a stressful environment.
Autumn is not alone. According to the Advocacy and Research on Reproductive Wellness of Incarcerated People, over 4% of women admitted yearly to state prisons are pregnant.
Pregnancy and the postpartum period are really just one piece of women's health behind bars, but it's a really unique piece. If we can't get this right, then we're probably not getting much other things right in terms of responding to women's unique needs.
Autumn gave birth to a baby girl and named her Reality. No family or friends were allowed in to visit, and she was given one phone call.
My family was responsible for picking her up. We had created a birthing plan. So I was fortunate that that did happen as planned, although I later found out that many girls' plans do not. And in those cases, devastating enough, their children are actually committed to the Child Protection Department.
Passing off Reality after they provided 36 hours together, Autumn returned to prison to finish the remainder of her 2.5-year sentence. On top of it all, Shakopee is a strict no-touch facility, meaning that no incarcerated individual may touch another in any capacity. After this unimaginable separation from her child, Autumn was not allowed to be physically consoled by anyone upon her return.
I couldn't fathom the idea of what it meant to be a no-touch facility until I got there. That's a trauma for me. For me, particularly, postpartum care was non existent, that I didn't get any postpartum care. So every woman after being brought home has to be strip searched after delivering. You are a full detail strip search, which I feel like was ridiculous. They took the pads, they took the gauze, and then I had no pain medication over the counter if I had ordered myself before, which I had not. The worst part of it all was that I wasn't able to breastfeed. I breastfed in the hospital to get my daughter the beginning nutrients. And then after returning, I had nothing, but I was engorged severely. I treated myself and got myself back to health, but I realized I was assigned to go back to work. And my 6 weeks was up. And I realized, hey, I never had a doctor's appointment.
Like the lack of prenatal care, Autumn actually didn't receive any postpartum care until October. Remember, she gave birth in June. The only reason she was called in for any at all was because of a fluke incident of being selected for a healthcare interview by none other than Dr. Schlafer.
And I remember her asking me about my postpartum care, and I told her, It's ironically, I never got any. So without being able to meet her or connect with her, have her even ask that one specific question, I never would have gotten that care.
Autumn worked to continue life where she was. She joined the parenting program at Shakopee, where she was allowed extended visit time with her children. She became a mentor in the prison, had a job, and was taking college courses. A year later, without warning, due to overpopulation in the prison, she was shipped out to a remote county jail.
I literally went 2.5 months in the county jails without seeing my kids at all. Our phone calls went from about 3 to 5 phone calls a day to 1 to 2 phone calls a week due to the inflation of the prices of phone calls. So it was pretty devastating. I think that was the worst period of my incarceration.
Autumn finished her sentence by transitioning to a workhouse within the community, where she began to integrate into a caregiving role again for her children. But this was not an easy switch, particularly for her youngest.
I believe that my daughter was traumatized in utero from the experience that I went through. So my daughter actually lived with and has worked through, in most cases, worked through a lot of anxieties of her own. And she's a lot more well-rounded now than she was when I came home. But we had to do a lot of work. We had to do a lot of work.
Autumn herself was diagnosed with depression upon her return, and her and her children now meet with a family therapist together.
My children and I have the type of bonding connection that is very special, very precious, that a lot of people cannot even imagine. I ended up having a fourth child, Reek Raven, and she is the final piece of the puzzle, and she kind of unifies our whole family experience.
Autumn now has committed her life to helping others overcome adverse experiences and spends her free time being outside with her children. This is Autumn's story, but she is in no way alone in her experiences. Now, Dr. Schlafer and her team are looking how best to address the issues faced by this vulnerable population behind bars.
On one hand, right, it is just like not having pregnant people in prisons, right? Like, how do we slow the flow of people who are coming in? And there's some judicial advocacy that could happen there. There's some education on that front. And how do we make sure that people who are there are getting help? The other aspect is like, for the people who are there, how do we improve the conditions of this space? And so I think for me, it is this like both and, like, how do we work with stakeholder groups who are doing work on criminal justice reform at a foundational level? And then how do we do legislative work around the needs that are specific to the people who are inside?
And as for Autumn, she hopes that change will occur at a community level.
So I never asked anyone to sympathize for me or to even have any remorse for me, but I always ask people to consider my children. Remember the faces and not the stories, and remember that we all deserve healing. We all deserve an opportunity to be empowered and to redeem ourselves, and that starts with a change in mindset in our community.
Petra Holtz, University of Minnesota School of Journalism.
With a presence all over campus and the greater metro area, street art or graffiti is a staple of any big city. In this segment, we will hear from reporter Ethan Olson as he unearths the origins of the art form. Here's Ethan with more.
Painting murals or drawing on the street are not new concepts. People have been doing this for decades, from the work of legendary street artist Banksy to the children you see using chalk to draw uneven suns on the sidewalk. Street art could be considered one of the more spontaneous forms of artistic expression, but it has also evolved immensely from its original and even more spontaneous form. But there is one aspect that street art and graffiti have not turned away from as these terms have grown, their influence on social and political movements. According to the History of American Graffiti by Roger Gassman and Caleb Nealon, street art, or its original name graffiti, started showing up in the U.S. on train cars and city walls in the 1920s and 30s. This was the work of young people and gangs, which was generally not accepted by other artists in the public. But from the fingers of these young people came a movement that allows for true artistic expression and the opportunities to question existing culture and biases. If you pay close attention to political activism, not only in the U.S. but across the world, you may have heard the name Banksy before. Active since the 1990s, Banksy has been using satirical street art as political commentary for years. The interesting thing about Banksy is, no one publicly knows his identity after decades of making art, which gives a focus on the actual meaning of the art, rather than the artist himself. This is exactly the basis of how street art activism is applied in today's political environment. And again, it works. In Minneapolis, since the tragic killing of George Floyd, street art has been a popular avenue for public outreach and a way for the public to truly speak their minds. Starting with the mural of George Floyd himself, sitting at the intersection of 38th Street and Chicago Avenue, downtown. And Minneapolis is not new to art covering walls and sidewalks. I mean, there's a mural of Bob Dylan that covers the entire side of a building in the center of downtown. But what the street art that I'm talking about offers is a chance to be heard. With so many people doing the talking on the issue of police brutality, street art helps people listen, and listen with their eyes rather than their ears. The Urban Art Mapping Research Project is a project started by University of St. Thomas professors Todd Lawrence, Heather Sheary, and Paul Laura. And this initiative is doing something very important, documenting and bringing awareness to street art of the Twin Cities. Sheary told the Star Tribune, "I felt like street art expresses something we don't see in our museums. It expresses the voice and experiences of people who are often marginalized from institutionalized presentations of art." One part of the research project is the documentation of the evolution of the anti-racist street art on the George Floyd Anti-Racist Street Art Database, where anyone can upload pictures and read about the artwork that visualizes racial disparities in our own communities. According to their website, the database serves, and will continue to serve, as a repository for pictures, but as well as a free resource for students and scholars, forever digitally documenting local art in a way that the physical form cannot always guarantee. The database currently has 1,742 items archived from around the Twin Cities area, organized into 9 different sections, labeled from George Floyd tributes to hope, unity, and community. The goal of collecting this art is, according to the website, to provide an avenue to analyze the themes and issues that appear in street art, but with a local twist. I encourage all of our listeners to look at this collection and to visit the art in person if you can. Listen and learn what is being said through this art, because this is art that represents hardship and change. There are real messages stemming from street art. They are not just symbols or collections of color. Street art can articulate the need for real change, and Banksy says it best. There's nothing more dangerous than someone who wants to make the world a better place. This is Ethan Olson of Radio K, signing out.
Prior to the cold and snowy weather we had to endure this winter, producer Emma Morris sat down with the local band Sapphire to discuss their music and ambitions. Bringing us happy conversations from simpler times, here's Emma with more.
Could you introduce yourselves to our listeners?
I'm Ava Levy, or just Ava. My pronouns are she, her. I'm Indy. My pronouns are they, them.
I'm Henry. I use he, him pronouns.
Could you describe Sapphire's music in a couple of words?
Totally. It's kind of like alternative indie pop punk girl music.
Girl power rock, man.
Does the band have a favorite or standout performance that they've done?
Well, we play a lot of house shows when we're able to. Not right now, obviously, but that's kind of like our main gig. But I'm trying to think about favorites. We did do one this summer. We did like a live session from Rochester that was really fun. It was for this festival called Rochester, and I loved that one.
What else?
The last
show we played
Not the paper house, the row house before it. Oh yeah, that one was fun too.
Do y'all have any funky or fun pre-performance rituals that you like to do?
We honestly don't really. We usually practice right before we play. Like that's kind of our thing. We usually do that, and then we'll usually like get coffee and just kind of try to relax, but nothing super specific.
Yeah, we usually just hang out since we're all buds. Yeah. So it's just like relaxed time.
Yeah.
If you could switch positions with anyone else in the band, who would it be?
God, I don't think I would be able to. But I would probably switch with Henry just for the fun of, like, I really want to learn how to play the drums, and I don't know how to do that, so I feel like it's just a fun, it would be a fun thing. And you're like, it's like an interesting aspect of the band because you just, like, don't speak or anything really. Like, sit there and do your thing. Yeah, they're all, yeah, the drum solos are pretty dope. Henry. I'd probably switch spots with Lily. I really like playing bass.
Yeah. One of our members isn't playing this show, this upcoming show with us, and she's also not, she's out of town right now, so.
I would love to play guitar. I don't play enough guitar.
Yeah.
If you could open for any performer, artist, who would it be?
That's such a good question.
Heim.
Heim, you say Heim?
Yeah.
That's a good one. I would probably like Snail Mail or Liz Phair, but 90s Liz Phair.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to open for The Garden.
How do you think COVID has affected your band and your individual creative processes?
I think I've gone through, like, just throughout the past, like, whatever long this has been, like 6 months or something now, I've gone through like a lot of just kind of waves of inspiration and feeling creative, but it really only lasts for like a week when I do feel like really creative, and then I'll like write a couple songs or start writing a couple songs and then quit on them and not feel creative for another like 2 months. But so it's definitely like hindered my creativity in a way, but it's also, I mean, it's been nice to just like have a lot of time in my brain to just like think about life and what I want to do musically and stuff. But it, I mean, it's been rough for like us as a whole just because we haven't really been able to do anything throughout COVID. We think we've kind of all been like writing in our own time, but besides that, like, we haven't been able to get together much. But yeah,
how about you guys?
During quarantine, I've also been kind of at like a creative block musically, but it's inspired me to be creative in other ways, like with all the protests and stuff happening. Ava and I and a bunch of all of us, even Henry, we've all been like trying to be pretty active, and it's kind of gotten us to be creative in a
totally different sense,
totally different way. But it's been kind of an impact that way. It's been,
yeah. I think it's also just like with the protests and the uprising this summer, I kind of like have just had a lot of like reality checks of like, okay, what is actually important in this world? What should I actually be spending my time doing? And like, music hasn't felt super important to me because of everything else, but
conversations have been really important. Our conversations have changed a lot.
And like trying to have social interaction without actually having social interaction.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
About you, Dave?
You've been making a lot of music.
Yeah. I mean, I personally have just felt like not having anything to look forward to, or like in specifically like shows, not having shows to look forward to is almost like deadlines, and having people kind of expect things to keep moving has left a lot of space. I just feel like I thrive when I don't have those kind of expectations like in the back of my head, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's been really easy to make, like, be a lot more creative for the purpose of like pleasing myself rather than
not so much pressure.
The purpose of like showing it off.
Yeah.
Is your family musical?
Yeah. My family is really musical, or like half of my family. My dad is a musician and his brother's a musician. And then my cousin's also a musician. So it's kind of just always been a part of my life because it's been in my family. But yeah, my mom also, like, my mom loves music and my sister loves music, but they don't play it. But so we're just pretty musical in general.
I'm the only musician in my family.
That's pretty wild.
I know.
Really, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so my entire upbringing, I mean, everyone appreciates different kinds of music in my family, like where my mom would like classic rock. My dad loves Kenny G or something.
Oh, bless.
I know. So it's been, I've just grown up listening to a lot of different music, and it's only made me a better musician myself.
Yeah. I'm kind of in the same boat as Indy. I have an uncle who is like a longtime musician, but he also lives like nowhere near me. So there's not much crossover.
Yeah. You know?
But it's like music has been part of my life since I was like 3. So
yeah.
Do you have any musical inspiration when you write music?
My inspiration when writing music does not relate to any of my parents' music. It kind of goes back into like more folksy music.
Me
I
too.
Listen to a lot of folk music. And I think
the main type of music I listened to for like the majority of my life was like 60s psych rock. Like I listened to a lot of the Beatles growing up. Mm-hmm. And so I think that kind of creeps into my writing without me noticing it. But like usually when I'm writing, I'll think more about like, I have already talked about her once, but like Liz Phair is just like one of my favorite musicians. And I kind of try to like emulate some of her styles, but yeah,
I hadn't heard of Liz Phair until you started playing her.
I love her.
Yeah, she was really good.
I don't know. I tend not to try, like, personally, I don't really like to think about the music that I like to listen to when I'm writing stuff, because it, just for myself, it tends to turn into, like, a very ingenuine result. You know, because that
you focus too hard.
It's just kind of like, it's like the path to getting way too far into my head.
Yeah.
What's the band's favorite song to perform?
I don't know. What's your two favorites? I don't even know what mine is.
I really like playing Monkey See, Monkey Monkey See. That's my favorite song.
It changes every time you play.
Yeah, I feel that too.
Depending on how practice goes.
I know. We have like a couple new songs that I really like playing just because we have only been playing them for like 6 months, whereas the other songs we've been playing for like 2 years, which is just, it gets exhausting after a while and a little boring. But yeah, we have a couple new ones that are fun and exciting every time we play them.
What's next for Sapphire?
I really don't know. Honestly, I feel like COVID has kind of like, we were gonna try to release a couple singles this summer, but then it just completely fell apart. And now we're just kind of going with the flow and figuring it out as we go along. Because also, we are all kind of in transitional periods. Like our bassist was moving to California. And so we were kind of trying to figure out how to like exist as a group without one of our people, and I think that we'll probably try to record something soonish once we get into the swing of school, but yeah, we're just kind of riding the wave right now.
Yeah, what I try to think about when thinking about Sapphire is kind of just like what Henry was saying earlier, is just writing for ourselves and writing what we believe sounds good and not letting the people we play for dictate what we write. Because what makes Sapphire is what we write and
totally
not what everybody else writes.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Where can we find you?
Let's see. Okay, well, Indy has an amazing Instagram page. It's called Revolution Radio Official.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
And they just post a lot of like really great resources and mutual aid stuff and information on protests. And so I would highly recommend following their Instagram. We also have a band Instagram that's sapphire.band, which we usually post like all of our shows and other fun stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, my personal Instagram account is aviator_000. And I just am pretty goofy on there.
Yeah.
Do some goofy stuff. We have a Facebook page too that is just Sapphire, I think.
For Real College Podcast, I'm Emma Morris.
That's all for this episode of Real College Podcast. As always, stay safe, Minnesota. We hope you stay happy, healthy, and connected. Until next time, signing off for Radio K's Real College Podcast, I'm Casey McCabe.